the novel coronavirus outbreak has business ramifications, not just health consequences. The threat of the infection has shut down factories that pump out goods from shoes to clothing to car parts and smartphone technology. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the economic impacts of the coronavirus here on The Morning Show. We're learning how this ripples throughout major markets and how it affects us as consumers. What questions do you have about a virus on the other side of the world and how it might affect business in the U.S.? Have you considered traveling to China but put those plans on hold now? Maybe you're still going. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings or shoot us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Ian Coxett is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Ian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Keely.
Help us understand the scope a little bit. What industries are actually affected by this this coronavirus spread?
Well, the disease is of course a story of contagion, contagion means that any kind of industry or activity where people congregate together is going to be the most vulnerable. So that's of course travel, tourism, retail, and those are the biggest directly affected industries at the moment because people don't want to go to shops, they don't want to buy luxury goods anymore, they don't want to be on cruise ships, they don't want to be on planes or in airports and so on. So that's obviously going to have a direct impact on those industries. The indirect impacts come through industries that can't keep their workers in place or are not allowed to keep their workers in place and therefore have to cut back or shut down production. And we're starting to see quite a lot of that, both in China and beyond as well.
And a lot of the last several months, we've been talking about how much of a production powerhouse China is. So yeah. When we are talking about factories shutting down or needing to cut back, that has a significant impact.
That will have a very significant impact, depending on the duration and the intensity of the virus. Now, right now, it's still in the exponential growth phase. We don't know how long that will last. We don't know when it's going to start to top out. And until we know that, we don't have a really good idea of what kind of economic impact this will have. But sure, China is in the middle of the world's supply chain for just about every manufactured product. So that means that if factories are not operating in China or if distribution networks are not operating in China or if local representatives of firms that are operating in China cannot visit their factories in China to supervise production, then, of course, that disrupts global supply chains for everything.
It's easy to think, well, of course, the people who work at the factory can't go to the factory, won't take home a paycheck, that initial firsthand impact of what this looks like. But it really could. I mean, Wisconsin exports almost $2 billion a year in goods to China. There's a relationship there. And so what happens firsthand in those factories can ripple.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So if you're thinking about the Wisconsin economy, sure, China is our third largest export market and our largest source of imports. So any disruption in the Chinese economy is undoubtedly going to have an impact in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Ian Coxett, who's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, studies trade, and has a specialty when it comes to Asia. And we're talking about how the coronavirus is changing business right now, not just having health effects. And we should mention that already 2 weeks ago, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross predicted the spread might be good for the U.S. economy. Here's a listen.
I think it will help to accelerate the return of jobs to North America, some to U.S., probably some to Mexico as well.
So could there be a silver lining for America when it comes to this job movement that Ross is mentioning?
Well, Mr. Ross is obviously referring to what he anticipates to be a shortening of global supply chain, something similar to what the U.S. administration has been trying to achieve with its tariff policies. So he's thinking about this as a win for the U.S. in the sense that people will not want to engage in international trade as much as they have in the past. Now, I think to say that that will have an impact on jobs in the U.S. is, let's call that optimistic. On the one hand, yeah, some jobs will come back to the U.S., but on the other hand, the number of those in net terms is likely to be very small, probably negative. Think about it this way. If the contagion is so great and so intense and of such long duration that the Chinese economy slows down by the amount that it's, some have predicted it to slow down, then, of course, that's one of the biggest U.S. markets coming off stream. Now, that means that a lot of companies in the U.S. who are engaged in trade with China, either selling products to China or sourcing products from China, are also going to be cutting back on employment. So the idea that we're going to get jobs out of this, I think, is just a political theater.
President Trump's chief economic advisor, though, Larry Kudlow, has said that exports for that phase one trade deal with China will take longer because of the coronavirus. He's kind of gone back and forth, but acknowledges that this is a wrinkle in our relationship with China. How do you think the outbreak might affect that, you know, newly minted deal where China's supposed to buy a bunch of goods from the U.S.?
Interestingly, the Chinese government a few days ago actually reduced tariffs on a whole range of goods beyond the first round trade deal parameters. I think they're doing that deliberately as a response, at least in part, as a response to the coronavirus outbreak, because they want to stimulate the Chinese economy. At the same time, they also injected a lot of additional funds into the Chinese economy with a bond purchase. The value of that was about $170 billion, which is around about a week's worth of production in China. So that's a very large economic stimulus. So those two measures, the trade measure and the monetary policy measure, are both intended, I think, to sustain the Chinese economy against this shock.
So there is an acknowledgement in China that this coronavirus is having economic effects right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And how then, when we are across the world, should we anticipate feeling the effects of that? Is this a long-term problem, or will we start noticing this soon?
It's too early to know what the ultimate spread and impact of this disease will be. We just don't know. That applies as much to the physical contagion as it does to the economic contagion. So the longer it lasts, the more we have production disrupted in China and ultimately, of course, in China's regional trading partners in the rest of East and Southeast Asia, then the greater the effect will be on the U.S. economy. You know, the western side of the Pacific, that is China, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, that adds up to almost 40% of the global economy. So if you take down 2 or 3 points of percentage points of growth per year from that part of the world economy, everyone will suffer.
And I certainly respect that we have to wait and see. We don't know what the extent is. And at the same time, there are companies that are trying to make business decisions now, trying to gauge what that effect might be. How do they go about that when the answer is full of uncertainty?
That's a really good question, Keely. The best example, I guess, we have of a prior incident of this type would be the SARS outbreak in 2003. So there is something to be learned from the SARS outbreak, and we can go back and examine that. The only thing that's different, well, among the many things that are different, is, of course, that this is going to be bigger for sure, and that China, the most affected country, is way, way bigger now and much more integrated in global markets than it was in 2003.
So whatever effects we might have seen during SARS will be amplified simply because of the numbers.
Absolutely. In 2003, China was 4% of the global economy. It's now 17%. Its degree of integration into the global market through supply chains is far, far greater than it was before. So the estimates of the impact of this contagion relative to SARS currently running at about 3-4 times greater than those of SARS. We don't, of course, know what the true numbers will be, but that's
right.
The estimate.
So far, Ian Coxhead is a professor of agriculture and applied economics at UW-Madison. We're talking about how the coronavirus epidemic might affect the economy, is affecting the economy, and we're taking your calls, your questions about what that might look like. What do you wonder about how you might feel the effects? Are you a farmer who deals with China? Maybe you've noticed a change in prices. Tell us what you're experiencing maybe as a small manufacturer and the concerns you might have about a Chinese recession. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, and this is The Morning Show. More people have now died from the coronavirus than SARS. The infectious disease from nearly two decades ago killed 774 people. The coronavirus death toll is now more than 1,000. And the fast-moving sickness is not just a health concern, but also an economic issue. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the ways that the coronavirus is affecting economies around the world, including American businesses and consumers. And we're taking your questions. What do you wonder about how the coronavirus could affect your daily life here in Wisconsin? Maybe you have a question about how the economies work together or how we could see the ripple effect. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. UW's Ian Coxhead studies globalization, trade, and labor with a focus on East and Southeast Asia. And we've been talking a lot about China, Ian, but this goes well beyond China, even though that's the epicenter of this disease. How are we seeing more happening in that Southeast Asian region?
So the countries that are closest to China, geographically closest, are also in general the most vulnerable to the spread of this disease. So if we think about physical contagion, then countries that are close to China have strong links with China through trade, through travel, through tourism. Countries with dense populations, high mobility of populations, weaker public health and sanitation infrastructure, and relatively weak government responses, those are the ones that are most vulnerable to the spread of the disease. So that means pretty much East and Southeast Asian economies, especially the low and middle income economies, where government capacity and infrastructure are not very strong, and where the response, I have to say, up till now has not been very rigorous from government. So that's the physical spread. And, of course, it's going to be very closely correlated with economic spread as well. So you think about the supply chain disruption that that China represents when it slows down. All of the other countries in East and Southeast Asia trade with the rest of the world very substantially through China. That is, they produce parts and components for machinery and electronics and other products, send those to China for finishing, and then they come from there to the U.S. or other rich country markets. So if China's factories are shutting down, then that means they're also not sourcing inputs from these other countries, and that will have a big spillover effect, a big economic contagion effect on those countries.
And a name familiar to people here in Wisconsin is Foxconn. It's one of the companies that was forced to temporarily close factories overseas in China, manufacturing smart parts for smartphones and computers. And could we see a shortage of goods then coming out of China because these components aren't manufactured right now?
We're already beginning to see that. It's working its way through the supply chain. So we're not seeing it in terms of empty shelves in supermarkets yet or in Best Buy. But we already have news of factories, for example, in the auto industry, which is a big part of global trade, shutting down or suspending production or cutting it back in Japan, in Korea, and in Italy because they can't source parts for their finished product from China. So that's beginning already.
So when GM has to temporarily shutter a few factories, we may not see it right away, but it could certainly have an effect on car sales in the United States later on.
Yeah, that's right. So short run, we'll see that impact because it's really hard to change sources in the short run. Longer run, companies will find alternative sources for their product, but that takes time. You can't just build that capacity straight away in another country.
Sure. Jason from Kenosha has a question this morning. Jason, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hi, thanks. Good morning. I was just wondering, and you might have covered this already while I was on the phone, but what I'm not familiar with Wuhan and what is really the product or what they produce in Wuhan. So I'm wondering what sectors of the economy are affected. You know, is it manufacturing? Is it agriculture? In our neighboring areas, are other parts of China affected as well, like Shenzhen, what they do?
Jason, thanks for the question. And we've talked about some of it, but what is affected and what might not be affected by the coronavirus?
Yeah. So Wuhan is a very big city in China, and it's a manufacturing center. So there's a lot of activity in the manufacturing sector, which has clearly come to a halt in Wuhan because nobody's going to work there anymore. So that's a very big part of it. The secondary part of it is that, of course, this outbreak took place during the Chinese New Year holiday, a time when a lot of people are on the move in China, going back to provinces that they came from. You know, China's population of internal migrants, workers in the labor force, it runs to several hundreds of millions of people. So to the extent that they are now not able to return to their workplace, we're going to see the spread from Wuhan industries all the way through the rest of China. And in fact, we're seeing that right now. The big provinces on the eastern seaboard in Guangdong and other eastern seaboard areas, they can no longer restart production after the New Year holiday because their workers are not able to return to their workplace.
So it'll start, it has started with the manufacturing centers, and then that in turn affects the rest of all of these different elements of the economy.
Yeah, that's right, Keely.
We're talking with Ian Coxhead, who's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, studies globalization, trade, labor, among other things. Ian also has a focus on East and Southeast Asia, and we are taking your calls and your questions about how this coronavirus spreading through specifically China for the most part right now is affecting the economic balance and business interests across the world. 800-642-1234 is the number that you can call. Ian, we know that Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell is set to talk to Congress, and he has confessed, he used the phrase very hard when it comes to understanding China's economy, admitted that the outbreak of the coronavirus is makes understanding that and working with that exponentially more difficult. Why is it so hard for us to get our arms around how China's economics work so then we can better understand how we fit into a more global picture?
I don't think it's so difficult to understand how we interact with China economically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what Mr. Powell said about that, but we have a very, very, very close trade relationship and investment relationship with China, and I think the Chinese economy, at least the market part of the economy, is very well understood. So that part's not a problem. What we don't know is the extent to which it's going to be impacted and the duration of that impact over the next months, quarters, or beyond.
Sometimes the idea of currency manipulation comes up, or you mentioned the fact that China has, included a stimulus to try to keep the economy afloat. So how much do the government influences in China really make a difference when we're trying to figure out what the full extent of this effect will be?
Yeah, they're going to be really huge.
Okay.
And again, there's a parallel with the physical contagion. So the actions taken by government or the lack of them is going to have a big impact on the physical spread. The same is true for the economic spread. I think the Chinese government anticipated that rather clearly about a week ago when they introduced this big fiscal stimulus. So the idea there is to make it easier for Chinese firms to maintain production even when their consumer market is getting soft.
And Patrick from here in Wisconsin wants to join in this conversation about the economics and the coronavirus. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning.
What did you want to say here? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've kind of been in this before. As a tier three, tier two purchasing agent, buyer, you know, if I know a tier is going on holiday, a tier is going shutdown, tier is going changeover, I'm always pushing for a build ahead, a ramp up, something that stimulates a little bit higher than the norm, just in case, you know, something happens. What if they can't restart? If something happens in their plant, I cannot have an interruption in my supply chain. So, you know, with that in mind, where's that material at? You know, is it on their docks? Is it on a ship on its way back to North America? Is it sitting on our docks? There's always a filler. Anyone who's, you know, certified in ISO and ASTM and all these other great things, you know, that's part of their management system is risk abatement. So
yeah, thanks, Patrick. I think we got the gist of your question. So Patrick is saying I can't afford an interruption in my supply chain. So how do we avoid that right now? Can we?
Well, I think, you know, Patrick's strategy is exactly right, but this is a very large unanticipated shock, and so not quite sure how you insure against that by in your business strategy. I think it depends really greatly on the extent to which firms producing final goods like automobiles or refrigerators or televisions have slack in their supply chain. If they're working on a just-in-time order fulfillment basis, then they're ordering their parts just-in-time as well. That means that they're really, really vulnerable to an unanticipated shutdown of the kind that we're seeing.
So you can try to plan ahead. You can try to get out ahead of those. But when your business model is based on this idea that I don't buy things I need until I need them, things like this can really interrupt your processes.
They can, unless you have an alternative source of supply, which would, I think, be pretty unusual for a lot of companies.
And would businesses maybe be looking for that now? Or is it a little too early to be concerned that China won't be able to restart some of these processes?
Oh, I think your caller is exactly right, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people thinking the way he is. Okay, if I can't source stuff from China, then where can I get it from? And they'll be hunting the world for alternative sources of supply.
All right. Well, we'll continue watching the spread, the control of the coronavirus, and therefore the economic impacts of it. And I'm sure we'll touch base again. Ian, we really appreciate your time today, breaking it down for us.
Thank you, Keely. It was a pleasure.
That was Ian Coxett, a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. And we've been talking about how the coronavirus is not just a health concern, but also is having economic effects across the world. Up next here on The Morning Show is news. Then Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate Daniel Kelly joins the program to discuss his campaign. It's the second of our interviews with all three of the candidates in next week's primary. Are you an undecided voter in the Supreme Court election? How much do you care about candidates' judicial philosophies or their past legal work or who's endorsed their campaigns? Call 800-642-1234 or email your question to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The primary vote in Wisconsin's campaign for state Supreme Court justice happens next week. We're inviting each candidate to talk with us about their priorities and positions regarding Wisconsin's highest court and the role they'd serve if elected. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The top two vote-getters in February 18th's primary advanced to the general Supreme Court election in April. And just like our conversation yesterday on The Morning Show, your calls are welcome today and tomorrow as we bring on different candidates. What questions do you have for someone who wants to serve on Wisconsin State Supreme Court for a decade? What do you want to say about the court's recent rulings or the way justices approach cases? The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can also email your ideas, your thoughts, your questions to ideas@wpr.org. Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky and Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone are in the primary. So is today's guest, Daniel Kelly. He's a candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He's also the incumbent appointed by Governor Scott Walker in 2016. Justice Kelly, thank you for being here on the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be on your show.
You're campaigning for your first 10-year term after Governor Walker appointed you to the bench 4 years ago. Why should voters keep you on the state's high court?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with the judicial philosophy that I've been bringing to the court since 2016 and that I have promoted since pretty much my entire career. And that has to do with an understanding of our responsibility being simply to apply the law as it is, as it's written, right? So when we look at the Constitution, that's a document that the people of Wisconsin have adopted and maintained for a very long time. And our responsibility to that is to be faithful to the text that the people have adopted and maintained. We apply that to the cases in front of us with neither fear nor favor for any party or position, and we simply use that to come to our judgment in the case and call that a good day's work. So it's all about the law. We don't make the law. We don't ignore the law. We don't play favorites with the law. We just take it as it's given to us, and we use that to decide our cases. And when we do that, then we're faithful to the Constitution, and we're faithful to the oath that we take, and most importantly, we're faithful to the people of Wisconsin.
What happens then as a constitutional textualist, as you're saying, we look at the text of it, how do you address cases then where a legal question is whether one part of the Constitution trumps another part of the Constitution?
Yeah, you know, that's actually, that very rarely happens. If you look at the Constitution in terms of what the words and the phrases meant when they were adopted, developed and adopted as a very coherent whole. So I describe myself as a textual originalist because I think that our responsibility is to look at the meaning of those words and phrases when they were adopted, because they were trying to convey a very specific thing. And we have to understand that, of course, language, the way we use language, changes over time. But those words and phrases had a very specific meaning at the time that they were adopted. So we do our research, we do our homework, and we figure out what did it mean, what was the original public understanding of those words and phrases, and then we apply that. And if you do that, then you don't have to worry about different parts of the Constitution contradicting themselves. That only really comes up when we import our personal preferences into the Constitution, and that eventually twists the meaning of the Constitution enough that it starts contradicting itself. So our role is to really set all that aside.
And so does that mean that when you are looking at the text of the laws, you're also taking into account evidence like legislative draft documents or public hearing testimony to better understand what lawmakers were thinking when they drafted this law?
Well, it depends. There is some use to material like that. So if we don't know what a word or phrase was publicly understood to mean, and we look at contemporaneous documents, both inside and outside the legislature, and we discover from that what those words meant, then we can have reference to that. What we don't do is look for legislative intent. So it's important that we just look at what the legislature enacted. You know, if you look at legislature like ours, we've got 99 assemblymen, we've got 33 senators, and one governor. And, you know, you get that number of people together, there might be, you know, 132, 133 different reasons for why someone voted for or against a bill. And there's really no way for us to peer inside their heads to figure out what each one of them intended by their vote and what they intended the words to accomplish. All we can look at is what they actually voted on. And those are the words of the bill. So we're looking just for that meaning, but we don't look for some unexpressed intent of some individual legislators.
Now that we've touched on your judicial philosophy, let's step back to the campaign aspect of it. We want to know, why are you a better candidate than your opponents there, Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone and Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky?
Well, I think one part of it has to do with the judicial philosophy that I've just described. So both of my opponents, they have a very different view of the court. So they believe that their responsibility is to, in their words, update the Constitution to reflect today's values and principles and whatnot. And I think that responsibility belongs to the people of Wisconsin. You know, the Constitution has a provision to change it. So if the people of Wisconsin decide that the circumstances today are sufficiently different, that our basic framework document needs to be changed, there is a methodology for doing that. And interestingly, it has nothing to do with judges, right? So the Constitution lays out how that document can be changed, and it doesn't give any role to the courts in doing that. So, but they look at the Constitution as more of a, I believe they describe it as a living document, something that they can reinterpret over and over again. And I think the problem there is that it brings their personal values and personal politics into the mix in deciding a case. And I think that's a significant problem. And then I think the other thing is it's a question of experience. I think that I have the broadest and deepest experience of the three of us. I have worked in the government sector. I've worked in the private sector, both in the profit, the nonprofit. I've worked in a small firm. I've started a firm of my own. I've also practiced in one of the oldest and most respected law firms in the state of Wisconsin. I've argued several cases to the Wisconsin Supreme Court before I came to the court, all of them successfully. I've handled innumerable appeals across Wisconsin and across the country as well. And in the circuit courts, I've represented individuals and small companies and large companies in courts all over the state of Wisconsin. I've litigated contracts, UCC, banking, insurance, professional liability, real estate, land use, administrative law, constitutional law, and a host of other areas of the law. And on top of that, I've been a Supreme Court justice since 2016. In that capacity, I've reviewed thousands of our fellow Wisconsinites' cases. I've heard hundreds of oral arguments, and I've written opinions on some of the state's most consequential cases. So I think that package of experience is what the people of Wisconsin are looking for in their justices.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Justice Daniel Kelly. He's campaigning for a 10-year term on the court. The top two finishers in next week's primary advance to an April election. And we wonder, what questions do you have for Justice Kelly? What do you want to know about his qualifications or positions? You can call 800-642-1234. That number again is 800-642-1234. Justice Kelly, in her stump speech this election, Judge Kurofsky says you always rule on the side of right-wing interests, and she's concerned that that's demonstrating an unfair bias in the cases before the court. I wonder if that's the case, or if you can point to some rulings where you've joined that fell against right-wing interests in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, we've been trying to unpack that statement for some time now. I think we've finally figured out what she's going on about with that accusation. I think what she's referring to is that there is a particular attorney who's argued several cases to our court, and he's done a very good job, and he's been very successful. So she kind of let it slip in the last forum that we had that really that's what she's talking about. She's not talking about parties. She's talking about a lawyer. So obviously, you know, I think everybody in Wisconsin understands the difference between a party and a lawyer. And she's worried that we agree with an attorney's arguments, apparently. But as far as ruling for right-wing interests, I looked at the cases that I think she's referring to. And let me just go through them real quick, because I don't hear any right-wing interests in it. So apparently one of the cases that she's concerned about dealt with taxpayers in the city of Eau Claire who objected to the tax dollars being given to wealthy redevelopers to redevelop a part of the city of Eau Claire. Another one apparently is a family who objected to having their home searched as a precondition to challenging a tax assessment. There's another that some taxpayers who wanted to ensure that the DPI was following a new piece of legislation, and so they asked for a declaratory judgment on that. There was a cemetery owner who wanted to buy a funeral home, and there was a law that prevented that, and he challenged that law.
We just have a moment left before we have to take a quick break. And so I wonder, are those cases that you're citing, you say that you joined necessarily against right-wing interests, or you didn't favor them when you're citing them?
Well, I don't know where the right-wing interests are.
Okay.
Like I said, I mean, these are taxpayers. These are, you know, a cemetery owner, a university professor who objected to being fired in violation of his contract. So I don't know what she's talking about when she says that we always rule in favor of right-wing interests, because I think those are the cases she's referring to.
Okay. Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate and current Justice Dan Kelly stays with us. He's making the case to get your vote in next week's nonpartisan primary so he can get on the general election ballot in April. What do you want to ask him? What do you want to know before casting your vote? What issues do you consider in Supreme Court elections? You have a line at 800-642-1234. Again, we're speaking with Justice Daniel Kelly. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Three people want to be a justice on Wisconsin State Supreme Court, but only two of them make it past next week's primary election. We're talking to all of the primary candidates here on the Ideas Network. Incumbent Justice Daniel Kelly is with us ahead of the February 18th vote. And we wonder, what questions do you have for High Court candidate Dan Kelly? What do you want to know about his qualifications or his positions? You can ask that question at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Justice Dan Kelly currently serves on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And Justice Kelly, on the campaign trail, you've pushed against the idea of the court rushing to adopt a rule saying when justices should remove themselves from cases. The phrase you used was political mischief. You were concerned about that potential.
Yeah, that's right.
What does that look like? What is political mischief that worries you?
Yeah, so what I'm worried about is individuals and interests making contributions and making allegations of favoritism in a way that could potentially force a justice off a case where there is no conflict of interest, there is no reasonable worry that he wouldn't be able to be impartial in the way he applies the law. And I think it fundamentally misunderstands the nature of our elective judiciary and the responsibility and good sense of the people of Wisconsin. So I'm always interested in ways that we can increase people's confidence in our courts and make them confident that they can find justice and that that's what we do every single day. So I'm always open to new ideas on that. But when those new ideas come, we need to balance that against what I explained, the potential political mischief that certain members of the court would try to push another member off. We've seen some propositions over the last number of years, but the problem is they're really thoroughly inconsistent with having an elective judiciary. There would just be too many instances in which justices would not be able to sit on a case because of a desired limitation on contributions that the people of Wisconsin have rejected. So I think this sort of thing belongs squarely in the hands of the people of Wisconsin in two ways. One, in adopting laws that they think are appropriate for their participation in the elective process, and so they don't aren't disqualified of having someone on the court who's been elected, preventing them from sitting on a case. And then number two, paying close attention to those people they have elected to make sure that they are conducting themselves in a way that they exercise the function of the Supreme Court, deciding cases without any reference to outside influences, and make sure that they're actually doing that properly.
And in the absence of those laws or those rules that would exist, then the onus is on justices on the court. So what are some examples of when you've decided to recuse yourself from a case when you realized that there was a conflict of interest there?
Yeah, so one just came up recently. So there was a challenge to certain voter rolls. There were people who there was indication that they had moved and not re-registered their to vote. And I looked at that, and it appears that it would affect potentially up to 200 some odd thousand voters. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, I believe that I can hear that case. I can apply the law to those facts and come to a judgment that has nothing to do with outside influence. However, I am a candidate in an election that case could potentially affect. And I thought, well, it's too much of an ask to ask the people of Wisconsin to look at me and say, well, can I be confident that he's going to decide this case without reference to the personal impact that it might have on his campaign. And I thought that was too much of an ask to make of the people of Wisconsin, and so I decided to recuse myself.
And simply, if someone donates $20,000 to your campaign, the maximum allowed amount, would you recuse yourself from cases involving them if they were parties in the future?
I don't think it's a blanket rule, no, because of a couple things. One, this is the limit that the people of Wisconsin have decided that they think is appropriate for a Supreme Court justice to receive in their campaign. So I don't think it's a blanket rule that would require recusal. What I do think is that each justice has to carefully consider that as they look at who made the contribution, under what circumstances. Because I can tell you, I've had some people make contributions to our campaign that have been major sacrifices for them. I mean, it may not have been a really large dollar amount, might not have been a $5,000 or $10,000 contribution, but it was a significant sacrifice to make the contribution. That's going to weigh on me more, perhaps, than somebody who gives a $20,000 contribution, the maximum allowable. But, that represents the interest on their bank account for a month, right? So
it really is going to be more specific to the situation as I look at it.
All right. We're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Justice Daniel Kelly. He's campaigning for a 10-year term on the court. And Larry from Sun Prairie has a question for us. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Hi. Just a quick question. Are judges, including Supreme Court justices, are they exempt from the open records law for requests like, I want to see a week's worth of email? And that's my question.
All right. Thanks, Larry. Justice Kelly, what's your response?
Well, Larry, that's a great question. You know, we've actually never been squarely presented with that question. And so I don't want to make any kind of a conclusory statement on that, because that's an issue that may come before the court, and I want to make sure that if it does, that I haven't prejudged the issue. I can say this: I've received open records requests, and I've always responded to them. I've never withheld anything on the basis that, you know, maybe the judiciary is not subject to that law. So we've always been responsive.
All right.
And as far as I'm aware, I think all the other members have been responsive as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Justice Kelly. And we should talk partisanship. I mean, this court is technically nonpartisan, and you're not running with political labels. But President Donald Trump, who is a Republican, mentioned his support for you in a campaign rally here in Wisconsin. What is the proper role for political parties in this race?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're right. It is nonpartisan. It's really important that it's nonpartisan.
And yet it looks because, partisan, though, from the outside because of these endorsements.
Right. So our responsibility as candidates for the court is to speak about the law and actually perform our responsibilities in a way that does not have any partisan slant to it. And so, you know, what the parties do and say in other outside groups, you know, I think our responsibility as members of the judiciary is to respect their exercise of their First Amendment rights. So if they want to endorse candidates, if they want to support candidates, if they want to work on behalf of candidates, I think that's all good and fair, because that's all activity that's protected by the First Amendment. And I'm adamant about those kinds of protections, that the people are free to do that as they wish or free not to as they wish. So I think when it comes to our role in court, though, one of the reasons that I decide cases the way I do and the way I write opinions is to make sure that people know that those partisan politics don't make their way into the court and the work that we do. So when I decide a case or write an opinion, I start with the law, obviously, that applies to the case. But then I use rigorous logic to move from those premises, the laws, down to the conclusion in that case and in that opinion. And as long as you can build an unbroken chain of logic between the law and the conclusion, then the people of Wisconsin can be confident that the conclusion is required by law and not by anyone's personal preferences or politics. Because as it turns out, logic doesn't care about your politics, right? It simply is. So that's why I think it's so important to write opinions that way, to decide opinions out cases that way, and to write really clearly so that our bosses, our fellow Wisconsinites, can look at the work that we do and be confident that the cases we're deciding are based on nothing but the law.
Justice Kelly, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Daniel Kelly is a candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He was appointed to the bench in 2016 by Governor Scott Walker. Kelly is in the primary race against Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky and law professor Ed Falone. We've invited all three candidates to talk with us ahead of next week's election. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.